I'm Chuck Osborne.
And I'm Michael Smith. Welcome to our podcast, which is presented by Assured Partners Investment Advisors,
where we talk investing and all things related in a way you can understand.
Woohoo!
Hey, this is Chuck.
This is Michael. It's Tuesday, May 5th, 2026. This is our 26th episode of our podcast.
Woohoo!
Chuck, what is on your mind?
Asset allocation, Michael. We are allocating some assets. And so we brought in a heavy hitter. We've got Andrew Jacobs Van Merlin with us, who is a co-portfolio manager for the T. Rowe Price Target Retirement Date Funds. Allocates roughly $585 billion. So I think he knows a little bit about what he's talking about. He's a CFA charter holder, has a MBA degree from Cambridge, and so which by default makes him the smartest person on the podcast today. And Andrew, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. And yourself?
I'm doing well. Thank you for joining us. We really we've been looking forward to this for a while. And so we'll start. I mean, I think most of our audience probably is familiar with the concept of the Target Retirement Date Fund. Almost everybody sees these now in their retirement plan. But maybe you just, for those that aren't as familiar, just talk about a little bit about what a Target Retirement Date Fund actually is.
Sure. I mean, I think its simplest form, it's a professionally managed portfolio, right? So it's really a professionally managed portfolio that's aligned with your retirement year. And for many plans and many participants in this, it's this do-it-for-me approach for investors with a long-term horizon. So it's basically a product that automatically adjusts your asset allocation over time in a it's what we call a glide path. And so if you think about the problem it's trying to solve, many people, my mom included, you know, they just don't have the time, the interest to like do this on themselves. And so we're simplifying that investment decision for them and trying to improve outcomes with, in effect, minimal participant engagement. I think the beauty of a target date fund or target retirement fund is the simplicity that it's providing to the investor, and the sophistication really happens underneath the hood. And we can talk about that in a little bit. It's really designed, if I kind of step back to kind of what's the value proposition, it's trying to basically mitigate some of the common investor mistakes. The first being either too much or too little risk, right? People tend to be very risky or very risk averse, but ultimately that should change through time and we shouldn't always be at these extremes. And the other piece is just that kind of behavioral aspect of chasing returns. When people do it themselves, they always look at kind of the league tables of what's done well, and you tend to like the things that have done well and not like the things that have done poorly, and you kind of chase these returns. And so if I think about what a target date really is, it's a product that does it for you. It's about taking the right risk at the right time to try to increase the likelihood of you achieving a successful retirement.
Yeah. That's a great definition. And, you know, I don't know if you know this about me, Andrew, but I'm really old. So I've been around for a long time. And, you know, the target dates actually started, at least in concept, back in 1993. I was already working. I don't think the two of you were. But
no, quite.
But it started by a group at Wells Fargo. It did not take off in the 90s because the concept in the 90s was more risk-based. We thought that people would want, if they want someone to do it for them, what they want is a conservative option, a moderate option, an aggressive option. The whole idea of doing it based on your age didn't really catch on. And that didn't really start. So in my mind, they really started around 2000. Y'all started y'all's in 2002, and y'all were the pioneers. And I remember vividly because we put Target Retirement Day funds, the T. Rowe Target Retirement Day funds, in the state of Illinois' 457 plan, which was a $3 billion plan, and that's back in 2004 when $3 billion was still a lot of money. and when we got to the finals, There were several people on the board making the decision that we were advising that were just confused as to what to do because no one had a 3-year track record. And it was one of my favorite finals because we actually got to talk about investment strategy and how people are constructing these things as opposed to just looking at, oh, well, what have you done over the last 3 years? And it's that decision that leads to long-term success. And in our view at that time, you know, you all were on the right side. And I think history has proven that you were on the right side in terms of having more equity along the glide path. The industry has now copied you. And so that's not as unique as it once was, although I think you still have that reputation. You know, your competitors were more conservative. And back then it was a relatively simple group. It was, you got basically your senior portfolio managers together and they voted on, okay, what the asset allocation should be. Now it's become a lot more sophisticated and you've been there through that entire history. So can you kind of describe the history of how these target date funds have evolved over the last 20 to 25 years?
Sure. Yeah. And so to me, so I think the game changer really was, you know, the Pension Protection Act when you know, that gave kind of fiduciaries ultimately the kind of the ability or kind of the cover to pick a qualified default investment alternative that was really focused on the long term. If I kind of take a step back, you know, I still remember the days when the defined contribution plan was very much focused. It was very much viewed by even participants like a savings account, something where, you know, kind of safety first, capital preservation. A lot of the defaults were cash equivalents. And you mentioned some target risks, but many of the target risks were kind of like more moderate target risk. And to me, what really kind of changed with the emergence of target date funds is this is only viewed as a long-term investing account. We're really trying to compound returns over long periods of time to generate higher balances at the point of retirement and increase your chances of being able to, you know, use those assets and support your spending in retirement. So I think there was a kind of a shift there with the Pension Protection Act in 2006. And before that, targets were very niche, as you said, you know, it's kind of like something that nobody was really sure, nobody really had a track record. And so if I think about the phase of innovation in the industry and kind of from in our focus, initially it was about the glide path. So let's think about kind of the risk level through time. And there were various, to your point, various flavors of that. And that industry has kind of coalesced around something that we ultimately developed early days, which is generally kind of that higher equity approach. And then the next phase of innovation in the industry was really kind of broadening. They were pretty simple portfolios in the beginning, some diversification, but it looked a lot like the core lineup that you see in most plans today. And if you look underneath the hood of a target date today, they're kind of that second phase of innovation was kind of broadening the diversification, including kind of more esoteric asset classes that aren't really appropriate for core menu. They're small pieces. They work really well in a multi-asset portfolio, but not something you necessarily, I think about long treasuries as an example. Something that sounds, you know, pretty safe, but ultimately it's a quite volatile asset class and works really well at hedging equity risk. So ultimately, so the second phase was really around the diversification, making this more of an institutional type of portfolio. But to me, the biggest thing when I think about kind of our rationale supporting the higher equity approach is just generally we were early, the most meaningful risk that retirement savers are facing versus kind of that more near-term market volatility risk.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And I think a lot of people don't understand how sophisticated the target retirement date fund has actually become over the years. And so we pulled some statistics, which I think are, you know, somewhat mind-boggling. I think, you know, even sophisticated investors, a lot of people, financial advisors, wealth managers, when they think of the most sophisticated asset allocators out there, they think of endowments and foundations. There's been a lot of talk in the wealth management world of using the quote-unquote endowment model. Mm-hmm. In terms of how you allocate, well, endowments and foundations as total, as of the end of 24, manage approximately $2.9 trillion. Now, that's a huge amount of money. Target retirement date funds manage $5.2 trillion, which is an enormous amount of money. It's almost equal. There's $6 trillion in public pension plans. So you think about the target retirement date funds today have almost equaled the entire public pension plan universe, which has been around, you know, since the, you know, the 30s and 40s.
Shrinking.
Building, you know, so it's amazing how much is in there. And I think the people don't understand exactly how, you know, sophisticated this is. So it's really an institutional program. Like, just talk a little bit about the team at, because I know we talked earlier about, like, well, someone may want to do it themselves. I don't think there are many people that are hiring 40 folks to to really get into granular detail about all assets.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, and again, you know, if I think about kind of the core DNA, when we built our target retirement funds on day one, it was about bringing, so we're a longstanding investment management firm, you know, hundreds of investment professionals. And really the kind of the North Star in day one was bringing together the best of our firm into one package for our investors. And so I think, again, the simplicity, so for investors, is kind of that one ticker, but underneath the hood, again, in terms of the process, you really have access to both kind of these micro perspectives of kind of analysts going, you know, across the world, researching companies, researching credits, as well as kind of top-down perspectives from portfolio managers like me and multi-asset, but also our fixed income team, our equity team. And so kind of back to your point, this really is an institutional caliber pool of capital where you're kind of bringing together all of these capabilities. And we've built a really large, I think we have one of the largest dedicated multi-asset investing teams focused on target date in the industry. They really kind of provide some of these capital market perspectives, also research on, you know, behavioral insights on what participants are doing, looking at demographics, savings rates, longevity, you know, how mortality, how people react in terms of, you know, volatility, et cetera, and kind of bringing this all together into this kind of one size fits most product that's supposed to do it for you and try to help you increase the likelihood of achieving that successful retirement. And so it is really something where you do get a lot of benefit and value in this package of kind of the breadth of resources and capabilities that are, you know, put to bear on these. And again, to your point, you know, why is that the case? Because this is one of the largest pools of capital in the world, right? And so ultimately, scale has allowed us and many of my competitors to staff up and bring all of these capabilities to bear and build these really sophisticated portfolios.
Can you can you talk a little bit about, you know, because I know over time you add asset classes, new things get brought in. Maybe from a high level, just talk about how those tend to get added, things that you're trying to solve as you're even broadening the portfolios and changing them.
Sure. So and I can maybe come, there's been a couple phases of this, whether it's internally at our firm at T. Rowe Price or in the industry, but I think in the beginning it was about building, you know, efficient risk-based portfolios, really including kind of global capital markets. So the breadth of global capital markets, building that, you know, sophisticated, efficient portfolio. So international, emerging markets and developed markets, investment grade and sub-investment grade, emerging market bonds, long duration bonds, short duration bonds, floating rate bonds. So bringing together things that really build out that diversification. At some point, you kind of own everything, right? It's kind of you own kind of the global capital markets. You kind of reach the efficiency frontier from in your portfolio construction. But I think there's still things that you can do. And if you think about a life cycle, the risks that investors face through time, that list is common, but the emphasis or the relevant importance of various risks do change. I think about one of the classic examples for me is inflation, right? So if I'm 25 years old, I have small balances in my 401k, I have a long time horizon, I'm just not so worried about the effect of inflation. I don't have a lot of bonds, but inflation really hurts your bonds. I have a long time horizon. I don't know what my, you know, I have this view on kind of what my life is, about getting my assets in the plan and getting them growing. But as you get closer to the point of retirement, when you have lots of bonds in your portfolio, your inflation hurts your purchasing power. So one, that's kind of your retirement liability. You need more dollars to fund the same amount of goods. it also hurts those kind of that larger allocation to bonds in your portfolio. So introducing things that have that ultimately hedge inflation rate become more relevant or more important as your time horizon shortens, as you get nearer and as you're in the point of spending down your capital. And so what you start to see is that it's not just about building efficient, like reaching the theoretical efficient frontier, but also using the components that you have access to in a way that really mitigates the most relevant risks that investors face at that point in their life cycle.
Yeah, that makes sense.
It does. And so I know at T. Rowe, and I don't want to, we don't want to throw some of your competitors under the bus. I know you and y'all aren't the only ones that have built out sophisticated teams. There are still some large groups that are doing it in a very simplified manner. But T. Rowe specifically, y'all talk a lot about the three different levels in which you can add value. And so can you kind of talk about how you actually add value through the process of building out a target retirement day fund?
Sure. So to us, there's basically three main components or sources of value add. The first is, and it's one that we've talked about quite a bit already today, probably because it's the most important, which is that glide path or ultimately the level of risk that investors bear through time has a very meaningful impact on the expectations in terms of, you know, how well funded you will be for retirement, so, or the returns that you'll compound through time. So we do a lot of work on that. So that's basically strategic asset allocation. So it's not just the level of risk, but which asset classes you include. So those are the kind of the two things that we've talked about already today. The next thing is ultimately, and you're kind of alluding to this, there's kind of two general approaches to a long-term problem. Having a long-term perspective and kind of staying the course. And some of our largest competitors, that's the approach. I will get you there over the long term. And you don't do much in between. It's really kind of that set it and forget it. But ultimately, things change quickly. Markets go through cycles. The outlooks can change relatively quick. And so we have an additional component to our process, which is our tactical asset allocation process. And that's really around adjusting the portfolio that emphasizes the more near-term market environment, not so much driving the portfolio, kind of making sharp turns, but really kind of adjusting course as the risk and rewards among asset classes start to shift over time. So trying to lean away from areas where you think the risk, the reward relative to the risk that you're taking is ultimately not advantageous, and trying to lean into areas where you think there's ultimately that risk reward is a bit more skewed in your favor. And so that's that concept of kind of steering through the cycle a bit versus staying the course. And that's because we've built these capabilities up over the last 30 years. And so we think we can do better than just kind of staying the course. We can adjust along the way and try to take advantage of kind of market dislocations or, you know, areas that are more or less compelling. And then the last piece, and this is one where, you know, you have many different views around this. We're an active manager. And so the last piece is kind of security selection of the underlying active managers in the portfolio. And this is really philosophical, right? So ultimately, if you look at kind of the long-term research, you'll see, I mean, investing is generally a zero-sum game. And so the average active manager tends to modestly underperform after fees. And I think the key here is you need to find somebody better than an average active manager. And so we've been doing this for a long time. We certainly feel that we're a quality active manager. And so we're using those capabilities in the portfolio to try to enhance those returns through active management.
Quick question about tactical allocation for you, Andrew. You know, we've been through this 10, 15-year period where like growth has just dominated everything. And it's made a lot of the levers to pull from an allocation standpoint, which happens to a lot of times be valuation, things like that, have less near-term impact.
Sure.
Has the length and duration of this changed how you guys think about tactical allocation at all? Or is it just a time, a space and time? Like how are you guys thinking about that and getting through this interesting time?
Yeah, no, it definitely has been. So it's been a really long cycle. And I, you know, it's funny. It's one thing that, you know, it just dawned on me just it's probably even just this year as I'm having conversations about the outlook. We haven't had a garden variety recession in a long time. And those are typically the points where the cycle could shift. Leadership, you know, the leaders of yesteryear change to the kind of a, and you could see, again, to your point around growth versus value, they tend to have pretty long cycles, but you tend to see often a catalyst that shifts leadership from one to the other. And we just haven't seen one of those in a while. Often that's kind of a, you know, a recession tends to be something where you kind of reset the portfolio, you kind of have a drawdown, throw out the baby with the bathwater, things kind of start to normalize, fundamentals start to matter again, and potentially kind of the things that were the most expensive kind of tend to lag a bit for a while, what things that were cheap tend to mean revert. But to your point, you know, the truth is valuation as a signal for tactical asset allocation, it's been a really poor signal in general, and even less good in this cycle because things continue to run. And so I think you have to lean into a little bit more. So again, I kind of come back to kind of a process. You want kind of a process that have bottom-up perspectives and top-down perspectives. And looking at kind of, well, what is going to, you know, what is going to cause market leadership to shift? Why would things continue? What are the key themes in the portfolio? And one of the things that's been really fascinating to watch is to look at many of the risk models that are being that have been produced by risk providers in an environment like this don't do a great job of predicting risks. It's kind of the basically the models show you, hey, you have a really low risk portfolio, and all of a sudden you have a massive drawdown as you have a a deep seek moment, or you have some of these kind of more catalyst driven moments. You're kind of like this, the risk model didn't see this risk coming because these are non-traditional risks. The way they define risk into these factors, it's not the factors that are in, it's more idiosyncratic or more thematic. And so I think, again, to my point, I think you have the kind of these top-down views that look at valuations, that look at the macro. But I think you need some of this fundamental bottom up, or kind of what are we seeing in practice? And, you know, like the theme of AI that's kind of been driving 2025. And also now again, later, you know, just this quarter in 2026, you know, it's a massive theme, a massive reacceleration of CapEx. But you can see how you can look at these things and say, hey, CapEx beneficiaries are going to have these tail. It's not just the Mag 7 who are ultimately writing these checks, but it's kind of who are they writing these checks to? And you're seeing even in the small cap space and kind of semis, in a couple of different areas, you're starting to see kind of really this dynamism, right? And so it's a long answer to your question, but I think the traditional tools, I think in an environment like this, I think you have to think about more about some of the thematics. You can't just rely on the kind of valuations, macro, interest rates, et cetera.
That's very interesting. And so we've had kind of some themes going on with our podcast in terms of we've had a lot of people come in and we've talked about how commodities and have really run and appear to be cycling. International and emerging markets has done, you know, far better after trailing for a long, long period of time. And, you know, these are things that obviously impact asset allocation. So can you talk a little bit about how some of these asset classes that perhaps had not done so well in the last cycle all of a sudden seem to be emerging?
Yeah, I mean, I think so, you know, think about so I think you're talking a little bit about kind of generally we saw a bit of a broadening trade. And, you know, so again, I think there are a few things going in play. I'll kind of talk a little bit about international, right? So I think you saw for years, right, international was cheap, but US was outperforming. It was almost like, is it cheap for a reason? Is kind of the most exciting places of markets really concentrated in the US? And there's ultimately some of these more thematic or long-term tailwinds to the U.S. market through our technology exposure. And you saw outside the United States having much more cyclical exposure, lower quality, macro that ultimately kind of slower growth areas, et cetera. And then you saw, you know, just last year, and you saw a bit of an inflection, one from the valuation piece. And so you saw, but not just valuation, I think you saw fundamentals being kind of ultimately being decent outside the United States. And then you had kind of the dollar on top of that. So you had a massive tailwind from the dollar. So when you kind of compound low valuation with mean reversion with, you know, low expectations for fundamentals that you outperform, plus kind of the dollar on top of that, it kind of compounds into these 30, 40% returns. And they were pretty sharp and quick. And I think the question is, there's a couple questions. One is like, is it going to be durable, or is this kind of a catch-up trade? And the other piece is kind of the more theoretical question. And, you know, I spent a lot of time defending what I would call diversifiers in my portfolio. Why have them at all? Right. And I think the U.S. Yeah. international, we've had a bit of a U.S. home bias for since our inception. But certainly we've been defending having any international in the portfolio. Similar to you mentioned commodities, you know, we've had real assets in our portfolios for over a decade. And yeah, there just hasn't been any inflation. You've had kind of you had the energy cycle, and you kind of and things kind of rolled over there. And so you were always kind of apologizing, like, why do we even want this on board? Because the honest answer is, the reason you want to be diversified, it's almost the only free lunch in investing. Things happen quickly, and so and it's really hard to time these things. And so you want to make sure that you have at least some exposure to diversifying in your portfolio. If you have environments like 2025 where you're exposed, you may not have been kind of fully on the right side of trade of the trade, but kind of having a zero weight to these things would have really left you out, kind of holding the bag.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, things do happen so quickly, because it just says, like we were mentioning, international outperformance and. And then all of a sudden, we get a war in the Middle East. And as impacted as we have been from fuel and oil and everything else, international emerging markets, places like India, it's the largest importer of oil in the world, they have been enormously impacted. I know y'all have a tactical piece, but to your point, it's not like, this isn't day trading.
Right.
So, how is your current view, being impacted by geopolitical events and stuff going on?
Yeah. And geopolitics is notoriously difficult to call, right? I view it as kind of like, if you kind of come back to like statistics, it's kind of like a fat tails. Things can turn around positively really quickly or negatively really quickly. And there's a decent amount of uncertainty. And in environments like those, like those aren't the ones that you want to lean into. You try to lean into fat pitches, right? Hey, at these valuations with this setup, the likelihood of me being on the right side of this trade is high, versus here, it's kind of, if I'm right, I look like a champion. If I'm wrong, I look really dumb. So in environments like this, I think you kind of hug your core. You kind of come back to the middle, right? You don't lean out on the wing too far, which is generally, from an overall risk perspective, we've been risk neutral. And then I think you pick your battles, right? And so we've had a broadening trade on in the portfolio. That's one that's done quite well this year. We've been kind of harvesting some of those gains in small caps and international, and kind of redeploying it in the areas that were kind of like the leaders of yesteryear. Kind of, we've been recently kind of buying growth companies. And then the other piece we've had in the portfolio, and this is one that's done quite well, you know, the original was inflation hedges. So we've been overweight TIPS and real assets. That wasn't because we thought there was a war in Iran. We actually thought inflation was stickier. We were already there. And then, you know, when the conflict started, it was one of those things where, wow, we're glad we have this in the portfolio. And it's one that's done quite well with kind of elevated commodity prices and the kind of the general, you've seen, you know, interest rates rise as a result. And so these inflation hedges have actually done quite well for us in the portfolio. So I would say that's one where we were already in the trade and kind of like we're very much more comfortable. It's an even higher conviction when this happened. But certainly, like I would say, from a risk perspective, geopolitics is notorious. You know, it's kind of, we could have a ceasefire or a truce tomorrow that's durable or not. And so this is really kind of a wide distribution of outcomes. And it's one where, we tend not to love to navigate in those really binary type outcome scenarios.
Absolutely.
Andrew, I think we're probably going to move here soon to kind of what's like next, what's going on, the next things. But I have one kind of question. Like, from an organization like you guys, you're very sophisticated, a lot of professionals together. You've already got a lot of wild tools that you're using quantitatively to do all this. Like, how are you guys thinking about AI and that rollout and how that fits on your process? And I mean, there's probably only so much you can talk about, but I'd definitely be interested to see how you think about that and what you guys are thinking.
Yeah, I mean, I think we can all agree that AI is a bit of a game changer for many things, whether it's your personal lives or your professional lives. So we want to be on the right side of change. And so there's, you know, from the top down, there's been really a really big push on finding ways to use AI throughout the organization, kind of everywhere. And part of that, to me, this reminds me a little bit of, like Excel. Everybody's self-taught in Excel, and everybody does. There's seven different ways to do any one thing, and we all do it a little bit differently. It's kind of how we learn how to do it. That's not a great way to, harness capabilities. And so we've been trying to share wins, like things that we like. I was having a conversation with an analyst the other day. I stole his idea because I loved it so much. I was like, what's your best way of using AI? And he's an industrials analyst. And he's like, hey, I have an hour and 15 minute commute in the morning. I hit the button to start chatting with AI, and I pick, a sub-industry or a company, and we talk about it the whole way to work. And I start to, it's doing that's the one thing that AI has been really good at so far. And it changes every day, right? Doing the legwork, doing some of the research, and not the things that need absolute precision and certainty, but kind of general information to kind of get you 80% of the way there, so you can start to do your own work on areas that you think are interesting. I think AI has been really good at doing that. So we've been using it for kind of macro. We've been using it, again, I stole his idea. I pick something every day. It's not always work related, but and my commute's a bit shorter than his. But I found that to be really useful to kind of help me. It's almost like my own podcast, but the prompted podcast in the morning. But generally, I think you're seeing it on the research side, helping to provide alternative perspectives. Coding is one, so building out software to do things. So I think we're early days, but I think we're really excited to be on the right side of change. And I think we have support throughout the organization to find ways to become more efficient, to learn more, to be asked better questions. So those are the kind of things that I think AI has been really helpful on so far. But it changes every day, right? It's such a dynamic market. Yeah. And certainly me, Chuck, you said you've been doing this for a while. I feel like I've been doing this for a while. I don't want to be the one who doesn't know how to use the tech. And so I make sure I use something every day. And we have many tools, but again, I think it's just really important to not be, not be left behind. These are great tools that really enhance, efficiency and knowledge sharing.
Yeah. I'm with you there, Andrew. I try to, you've got to keep learning. You've got to keep learning. And that's one of the great things about our business, is that you can do that for a very long period of time. I want to get back a little bit to like the mechanics of the target retirement date, because, for the entire history of defined contribution, which is primarily 401k plans is the way most people think of it, we have been accumulating assets.
Mm-hmm.
And, accumulating assets for people is, I'm not saying it's easy, but it's relatively simple. I mean, you want to invest prudently, manage risk, but we're all trying to, get a positive investment return. We're now talking about a lot of people retiring with these retirement plans and decumulating the assets. And that becomes a little more difficult, I think, for the industry, because every individual has a different situation. And
that's right.
Yeah. And so, what are y'all seeing? What are y'all doing in your target date funds to help the people who are in retirement and looking to start living off the assets that they've built up?
Yeah. I think so. I think you said it well. It's complicated. That's been the issue. That's why you haven't really seen. So you haven't seen that same kind of coalescence of the industry on kind of a single solution as the way to go, because I think generally speaking, a single solution is not what people need. I think we need something that helps us make decisions and offers us choices, which is almost kind of the opposite of a target date, right? So if you think about it, it's kind of like and that's because on the accumulation side, one, I think let's not forget that on the accumulation side, a lot of your outcome is in the future. You don't have money. When you're 25, you have no past. When you're 35, you have a little bit of a past, but a big future. And so what we're talking about here is people who are 55, 60 or 65 years old, and they kind of have their own past. They have what they've been able to achieve so far. And that becomes, in effect, kind of narrowing on what their future could look like, right? You've either been a good saver or a bad saver. You've either had good markets or bad markets. And kind of, so it starts to rein in the kind of what your choices are. And what's been really difficult as well for the industry is most people no longer work with a single employer for their whole careers. And so everybody has these little pockets of money. And so we look at these stats through, you know, big organizations like EBRI, and you're kind of like the balance for a 65-year-old in their defined contribution plan is like $95,000. And it's kind of like, oh, well, it's, we don't have an income issue. We have a savings issue. Like, well, we probably do have a savings issue, but that's a small piece. That's probably, you know, an employer. They haven't consolidated. They haven't engaged. And so I kind of come back to, and sorry, I'm going on so long on this, but we talked a little bit about target date funds. What we didn't talk about is we talked about pension protection, but auto-enrollment, auto-escalation, and default has really been a powerful tools to build, you know, balances in 401ks. But what it's done is made people kind of disengage from their own future, right? And I think for the decumulation side, the first thing you need to do is you need to engage. You need to consolidate your assets, whether it be, you know, digitally or actually together. You need to make a plan. And you need to have choices for that. And so it's just really difficult to do without those first couple pieces, which is engagement, consolidation. It's hard to make a plan. And so what you've seen, there's been a couple different takes on this. One is around embedding kind of an insurance asset class instead of target date fund. The issue with that is it's sized on whatever you see, your balance, right? But now that $95,000 balance, you'd have 30% of that in an annuity, which gives you, you know, congratulations, use $150 for the rest of your life. Not helpful in solving an outcome, right? So we haven't gone that approach of kind of embedding yet. I do like the concept of kind of hedging long-term liabilities through time, like not just doing it on the day you retire, but start to buy into lifetime income throughout the point, throughout your accumulation journey. But I don't love doing that one size fits all. I'd much rather do that something that's more flexible to your needs and to your circumstances. And here's where you kind of come to advice, whether it be a managed account or something like that, something that allows you to size that allocation for yourself. So generally speaking, I think that's our view is we've been on a couple products. It's about getting choice. Some of them are insured, some of them are not insured, but I think it's they've been pretty slow to scale like everybody else is. And that's because I don't think product is the way to solve this. I think engagement, choice, and advice are the way to really solve that decumulation.
Yeah, it's not a product issue is a real powerful idea to me with that. We're in a product business, but it's really not a product issue.
That's right.
Well, that's right. And then we're getting back. We're kind of getting close to wrapping up where we started. I'm old. you know, it wasn't always a product business. And I think sometimes it needs to kind of go back. It used to be a service. Mm-hmm. And we need to go back a little bit. The productizing has been very good for the industry. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, if you're a financial advisor and you want to spend all your time in front of people and you don't want to be sitting there at a desk and actually coming up with investment ideas, then, oh, we have a product and I can, you know, the advisor can do what they're best at. The manager can do what they're best at. It works great for the industry and it works great for accumulating assets. But to your point, when it comes to retirement, it really needs to be a service and needs to be tailored for everyone. So I love hearing that. I do want to touch before we leave, though, on because there is one change, you know, and potentially in the defined contribution world, and that's the addition of so-called alternative assets, which are really, I think, more about private assets, both private equity and private debt. And what is y'all's view on that? What is T. Rowe doing, and what have you done? Because as you mentioned, really in inside the target retirement date funds, you pretty much are investing in the entire investable universe.
So. Yeah, and so you know, I would say so spot on. I think that's kind of from a starting point. Private assets alternatives feel like the last frontier, right? It's the only thing that's not already in the portfolio today. And so certainly from where I sit as an asset allocator, I view kind of asset classes as a bit like a chef in the spice rack, right? More spices is better than less spices. Yeah. certainly as kind of choice. So it's one of these things where, generally speaking, I think there are advantages to kind of expanding the opportunity set, and you're starting to see some traction on that side, particularly on structure. So generally speaking, what's kind of held back private equity, private credit, et cetera, from kind of being broadly within the defined contribution space today, it's generally liquidity, valuation, and cost, plus implementation as well. The 401k space works in a daily priced, daily transacted world. And these asset classes tend to price less often, monthly or quarterly, and don't allow for kind of daily liquidity, and often don't have daily valuation. So it's kind of like mixing apples and oranges. So there's the theoretical, right? Do I want access to, and you look at some of the data, and you kind of the number of listed companies in the world has gone down over time, more companies are staying private longer. You know, am I missing out on a significant part of the market that's really dynamic in our target date portfolios? And if I am, I want it, right? But certainly there's this concept that these could be return enhancers, private credit as well. There's kind of an exit spread for a similar rated company. And I'd like to, you know, harvest that excess in the portfolio. And then you kind of come back to the, you know, the goals of my investors, long-term focused. They tend not to trade a lot. They tend to kind of generally undersave versus they need. They need kind of higher returns. So compounding these returns should be helpful. So it's kind of an alignment of interest. So I think to bring it all together, I think there's been some evolution on the structure side. So the emergence of semi-liquid vehicles that offer some liquidity. You're starting to see products that have a daily valuation, even if you can only subscribe. And generally speaking, if it's a small part of our portfolio, if you think I manage less liquid assets, small cap, emerging markets, floating rate loans, and we have liquidity constrained asset classes already. And so to me, this feels like an extension of what we already do in the portfolio. We manage these risks already. So I think there's a general kind of alignment of interest between what we're trying to do and what these asset classes offer. Price is the one thing we want to talk about. They're expensive, right? Ultimately, in price in the 401k DC space, high prices is generally not a place. You know, it's been a low cost area. Margins have gone down over time to the benefit of shareholders, right? And certainly bringing in something that costs 3 or 4 or 5 times more than what you fund it from is difficult to do in this space. And so I think what you're going to see and what we're doing is new products, right? So products with potentially higher fees that include these from, you know, with a reasonable allocation of these. And it's kind of, you know what you get when you get in there. What's more difficult to do is kind of retrofit kind of a efficiently priced portfolio with some of these more, you know, expensive asset classes. And then the other piece is, you know, liquidity risk. I think it's something that can be managed, particularly in a target date fund. The beauty of target date funds is predictable flows and lots of, you know, ongoing inflows. And the best way to manage liquidity risk is with inflows, right? When do you need liquidity? When you need to fund an outflow? And so I think there's generally a way that we can find a way to manage some of those liquidity risks in here. So to me, it's really around price and performance, right? So the other piece is a lot of these new structures, to your point, Chuck, before, it almost feels like the beginning of target date. They just incepted last month, right? So it's like, yeah, I have a new product, a new idea. Are you interested? And I have a high price. So I think what we'll see, generally speaking, is, you know, talk to me in 3 years when these products have track records, potentially fees may have come down a little bit. I think it'd be much more mainstream than it is today.
Yeah, I agree. I think in the long term, this makes sense. The question we have, obviously, the price is a big issue because that's just the cost of private assets. But there's also the price in terms of the valuation of private assets.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's a lot of people who are, I think, rightfully concerned about are they looking for that one last sucker who's going to
it's fair. And I think that, you know, and to be Chuck, those are there's two questions in there, there's two kind of thoughts in there. Is one, do you want this in your portfolio all else equal over the long term? And I think the answer to that for many people is I'd like to have this. I'd like to have a return enhancer in my portfolio. The other question is, should you put your first dollar to work today? And I think that's a different question. I think today we're probably much closer to late cycle for some of the, you know, asset classes are cyclical, right? Mm-hmm. And so late cycle, you tend to have kind of, we talked about, is the risk reward compelling? at this point in time. And it's probably less compelling today than it was 5 years ago. And so if I haven't done this yet, is today the day that I want to put my first dollar of capital to work? Yeah, maybe I'll wait for the new cycle, particularly when these things are expensive. I'm going to have to pay those fees regardless. So certainly, I think so you have two questions there. I would say on the first one, I'm a yes. I think longer term, I think we'll find ways to include these in target date portfolios. Is today the day? I think some people just want this in their portfolio. They're that long-term focus. It's kind of like, yeah, maybe I'm going to get the end of this cycle, but over 30 years, I'll do just fine. But I think I'm more balanced on that second question.
Yeah, and I think I will wrap it up there because that kind of gets us back to the beginning. One of the things I loved about that experience in 2004 when we selected T. Rowe to be a target retirement date provider and there was no three-year track record is that you couldn't look back. And unfortunately, that's what too many investors do. They look back over what's happened over the last 5, 10, 15 years. And they say, now I want to get into this. And you got to look forward. And so much of the forward progress is based more on fundamentals. And when you're picking a manager, it's about how do they actually do the job? What is their philosophy and how do they do that? And I just want to thank you for spending time because I think you guys are one of the group. You're not the only ones, but you are one of the group that do it the right way. And we have enjoyed partnering with y'all for a long time. And our clients have benefited from that. So we appreciate it. We appreciate your time today, Andrew.
My pleasure.
And we usually at this point talk about where you can find it, but I think people know where to find T. Rowe Price. So
yeah, it's not so difficult.
Hopefully if they're listening to our podcast, they do. And Thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
Right. Appreciate it.
Chuck Osborne and Michael Smith are investment advisors, representative of Assured Partners Investment Advisors, LLC, a registered investment advisor. All statements and opinions expressed in this program are based upon information considered reliable, although statements or opinions are subject to change without notice. Information expressed does not consider the specific situation or objectives of any person and is not intended as a recommendation appropriate for any person. Viewers are encouraged to seek advice from a tax or legal professional or investment advisor to determine whether any information presented may be suitable for their specific situation. Information presented is for educational purposes only and does not intend to make an offer or solicitation for the sale or purchase of any specific securities, investments, or investment strategies. Investments involve risk, and unless otherwise stated, are not guaranteed.